I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Colin McCann began his writing life as a journalist in Ireland and has since become an award-winning writer of books of fiction and nonfiction, including Let the Great World Spin, that won the National Book Award. He lives in New York now and teaches creative writing at Hunter College. His new book, Letters to a Young Writer, draws from his experiences of putting pen to page. The chapter titles tell you, though, that his advice is for more than just writers. Here are a few. There are no rules. Shaping the truth. Be a camera. The habit of hoping. Fail, fail, fail. If you're done, you've only just begun. The dark dogs of the mind. I sat down with McCann a few weeks ago when he was in Philadelphia to ask him about those suggestions and about his life as a writer. We began with a quote from poet and novelist Rainer Maria Rilke. You quote, is it Rilke?
Rilke, yeah.
Ask yourself, in the most silent hour, must I write?
Mm-hmm.
Was that a question you asked yourself? Maybe not in the way Rilke intended it, but was that something that has driven you as a writer?
Still does. I mean, every time I finish a book, I'm on book 10 now at this stage, but every time I finish a book, I ask myself, am I able to do it anymore? Did I just hoodwink everybody? Am I, you know, going to be revealed as the charlatan? I sometimes think I am at the end of a book. And then I ask myself, why write? Why write? Why write? And, you know, does it make any difference? Does it have any effect on how the world, progresses in any way? And I come to the conclusion that it matters. It has to matter. Mm-hmm. Stories, our stories about each other matter.
But it sounds like it needs to matter to the writer,
mm-hmm.
to you, but also matter to the world, the reader.
I think it has to matter to the world. I mean, there are certain writers who would say you can write for entertainment, you can write to make people laugh, you can write to highlight different things. For me, the idea of being a socially engaged writer, a person who feels that they must have something to say in order to maybe, you know, turn the tide a little bit, is important to me. It's a little bit pretentious, potentially, right? And you have to check yourself, and you have to, carry your humility on like bricks on your back, because if you think that you have something important to say, you can sometimes get a little bit didactic about it. And really, what I'm interested in is sort of allowing people a different experience when they get into one of my stories.
But what's so interesting, you're an accomplished writer, you've won prestigious awards, and yet that feeling of being an imposter, mm-hmm. or maybe not good enough, that's still with you?
Yeah, it's good.
It's good to have that.
Yeah, I cultivate it. Like, my favorite quote it's quite a well-known quote by Samuel Beckett, which is, no matter, try again, fail better. And I love that sort of notion of trying so hard that you know that you're going to be vivified by a form of failure. You're going to fall at some stage. And there's something about that people forget that being a writer is, there's something athletic about it. You got to have stamina. You got to have desire. You got to have perseverance. And you got to get out there every day and work away at it and fail.
And put your butt or your arse, I think. Put it in the, you
got
to sit.
Put my arse in the chair.
In the chair. I mean, that's part of writing, right?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it won't be there unless you're there. It's all bad until it isn't, And that's the sort of desire to sit down and open things up and open your heart up is what propels me every single day.
Well, I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your new book, Letters to a Young Writer.
Sure. And this is, I quote Rilke at the beginning, who says, I live my life in widening circles that reach out across the world. Do the things that do not compute. Be earnest. Be devoted. Be subversive of ease. Read aloud. Risk yourself. Do not be afraid of sentiment, even when others call it sentimentality. Be ready to get ripped to pieces. It happens. Permit yourself anger. Fail. Take pause. Accept the rejections. Be vivified by collapse. Practice resuscitation. Have wonder. Bear your portion of the world. Find a reader you trust. They must trust you back. Be a student, not a teacher, even when you teach. Don't BS yourself. If you believe the good reviews, you must believe the bad. Still, don't hammer yourself down. Don't allow your heart to harden. Face it, The cynics have better one-liners than we do. Take heart, they can never finish their stories. Enjoy difficulty, embrace mystery, find the universal in the local, put your faith in language, character will follow, and plot too will eventually emerge. Push yourself further. Do not tread water. It is possible to survive that way, but impossible to write. Never be satisfied. Transcend the personal. Have trust in the staying power of what is good. We get our voice from the voices of others. Read promiscuously. Imitate, copy, but become your own voice. Write about that which you want to know. Better still, write toward that which you don't know. The best work comes from outside yourself. Only then will it reach within. Be bold in the face of the blank sheet. Restore what has been ridiculed by others. Write beyond despair. Make justice from reality. Sing and make vision from the dark.
That's Colm McCann reading from the very beginning of his new book, Letters to a Young Writer. And not to be too psychobabbly here, but those are words to live by, not just to write by.
It's kind of a book of, yeah, you know, my writing life
intersects. And that's not to take away anything that you just said.
No, my writing life sort of intersects with the way that I want to live. And so I sort of tell the stories that I feel are necessary for me as a way to operate in the world as well. So I wrote a book called Let the Great World Spin about, you know, Philippe Petit doing the tightrope walk across the World Trade Center towers. But really it's a symphony of the city about all these different voices and how all these different voices actually really truly matter.
You write so many interesting things in here. Write about that which you want to know. And I know oftentimes writers will say, well, write what you know.
Yeah.
You're saying, no, that's actually not necessarily good advice.
It's complicated. The people who tell you to write what you know, they're entirely correct, but they're saying it the wrong way. I would say write what you don't know, and when you write towards what you don't know, you will discover things that you knew but you weren't entirely aware of. It's a kind of a miracle of making a leap into the unknown, and so you're not comfortable anymore. You're sort of out of your skin a little bit, and you're finding out things about yourself and about the world that you weren't necessarily aware of. And somehow that makes the story more poignant, more real, more raw. And so the writing teacher who tells you you should write what you know, they're correct, because it's logically, philosophically impossible to write what you don't know.
Right.
But if you write toward what you don't know, you might have a lot of fun too.
This book also has a lot of very practical advice, including that the first line, which makes sense, the first line, I don't know if that's the most important, but it has to be, I get really good, I guess.
I say the first
line. And perhaps
line,
the last line as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The first line sort of has to open up the rib cage in a way and say to the reader, you know, trust me, this is going to be worth it. You're going to spend some time, you know, on this journey. It might confuse you or whatever it happens to be, but we will get towards the last line. And at the end, the final line should allow the reader to interpret it for herself. And that's, see, I don't want to put my vision on the world. I don't want to tell anybody how to think. We have enough politicians telling us how to think.
Every day.
But if I allow someone a new experience and they can look at the world a little bit differently, then I've absolutely done my job.
Do you sometimes spend weeks, months, maybe even years till you get that first line?
Certainly months. I've been close on years to get in getting the first line. Sometimes it comes to you, you know, right away, like a pillar of light, some sort of comes down. But then other times it's like deep in the work that you find the actual first line.
I interview a lot of writers on the show, and some of them love the act of writing. Mm. For others, it's pain from sort of start to finish. It's just pulling things out of themselves. What is it for you?
I like it.
You enjoy it?
Yeah. I don't entirely trust those people who say it's a demon. I think they're looking for a slight pat on the back. I mean, yeah, writing's hard, but guess what? Carpentry's hard. Being a police officer is hard. Being a radio host is hard. A lot of things are. And I don't triumph this profession over any other, but I do believe that in this profession, what we have to do is be sort of deeply empathetic to the difficulties of others rather than oneself.
Mm. In fact, you quote about being kind.
Yeah, isn't that...
But not too kind, right?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, You know, there are a lot of philosophers and down through history who've like engaged with all sorts of like deep problems about being and God and everything like that. But a lot of people towards the end of their life, they tend to say things like, gosh, I wish I had been kinder. Or now I think it was Huxley said, now I realize at the end of my life, you know, the best thing to do is to just be a little bit better to people. Wow. And look after one another, which sounds corny, but it's not. See, I think you have to be prepared to risk yourself. I hate when people say that optimism is corny or soft somehow. I'm interested in really muscular optimism because I'll take any cynic on and I will go into the corner with him or her and I will debate them and I will admit that they're right. The world is awful. But so what? Big deal. That's not a great revelation to me anymore. The world is awful. Why not somehow make it a little bit better? That's the task at hand. And that has to be seen as something tough because otherwise people will ridicule it.
Sure, sure. You're from Ireland, so you say it's important to read James Joyce. I've done readings for Bloomsday here in Philadelphia, and it takes me about 75 readings to really understand what it is. I mean, you're sort of plopped in the middle of the story, but still to really understand what this writer is writing about.
It's an amazing book.
It is. In the beginning, to me, it's almost inscrutable. And then just the more you do it, you begin, not just the language, but also you begin to sense what the story is.
Right. Well, I mean, Bloomsday is my favorite day of the year. It's the thinking man's Paddy's Day. And I just love it. It's in the middle of summer, June 16th, and you get out. And we, in New York, where I live now, we go down to Stone Street, which is the oldest paved street in Manhattan, and we read from it. And this actress, Aideen Maloney, who's the daughter of Paddy Maloney from The Chieftains.
Oh, goodness.
She does Molly's soliloquy. And I got to tell you, like even the fellas who are on their way to Wall Street, you know, and their brokerage jobs, they are stopped and they are awestruck at this woman, and also what she's saying, because it's naughty, it's dirty,
totally naughty,
and fantastic, and funny, and difficult, and all of these things that maybe good books should be. But really, it's about 24 hours in the life of a man wandering around Dublin in 1904. It's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant compendium of human experience.
So if you want to be a good writer, read Joyce.
Yeah, well, I didn't read Joyce till I was in my mid-20s. My son now is about to read Joyce, and he's like 18, and I envy him the experience. You know, you don't have to read Joyce in order to be a great writer. In fact, my friend Roddy Doyle said at one stage, he said, what Joyce needed was a good editor.
Well, it is a long book, isn't it?
It is a long book.
That's Colin McCann with advice for writing and for living. His latest book is Letters to a Young Writer. We'll talk more after this short break and then later in the hour, public apologies. We've heard attempts at them recently. We'll talk about why it's so tough and why it's so important to say I'm sorry. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let's get back to my conversation with Colin McCann. He's a prolific and award-winning writer of fiction and nonfiction. He's also been a contributor to The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, and The Paris Review. He co-founded a story exchange organization called Narrative 4. We've been talking about his new book, Letters to a Young Writer. Again, reading your book, I was reminded of a number of actors that I've talked to about how they, the kind of work that goes into understanding a character and creating a backstory and visualizing them and all of that. And it sounds the way you write about character that for a writer, it's a similar thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit of a method person. I mean, I'd wrote a book called Transatlantic, and in that book, there was a flight across across the first transatlantic flight across the ocean. And so I learned how to fly an antique plane. But that was fun to do, you know. I've done...
Because you wanted to know what it felt like?
Yeah, yeah. And I do sort of weird thing. I mean, 30 years ago, I took a bicycle across the United States for about a year and a half, and I met all sorts of people and gathered stories from them. I've walked across Ireland numerous times. I intend at some stage to walk from the States down to Patagonia or Chile or something like that, just because, I mean, I think we've got to do do
get out of our crazy selves
things.
A little bit.
Yeah. I like, as I say to the young writers, I say, do the things that do not compute. You know, don't do the ordinary thing. The thing that's acceptable. All the parents out there are going to hate me, including myself, if I was listening to myself, because I have a 20-year-old and an 18-year-old, and me telling them to do something that's wild and off the radar is a little bit scary, even to me. But I know they have to do it.
Which also, it seems, I mean, writing is, I guess, sitting somewhere, whereas walking across the United States is sort of the opposite of that.
Yeah, but it seems to me that you're going on a similar sort of journey. You're making that leap into the unknown, and you're every day it feels like you're opening up a new vista, a new landscape. Sometimes it fails, sometimes it collapses, and that's okay. You got to pick yourself up and. You know, I teach writing at Hunter College in New York, and we get some of the best young writers in the United States. But I'll tell you this, that like I'll get the kid and she has 100% of the talent and only 80% of the desire. Uh-huh. And that other kid, she has 100% of the desire and only 80% of the talent. The one with the desire will always, I guarantee you, be the one who actually comes out with a book and makes a mark on the world. There's something about fire that's different to sort of knowledge. And the fire can sort of like bring about the knowledge in a way.
Well, and fire is dangerous, right?
Yeah, well, that's
right. I mean,
there's
the attraction.
I mean, fire's good. You know, we cook things. We need fire to survive. But also, fire can destroy these things around us. So having those contradictory... I think, in today's political culture, we're afraid to hold contradictory ideas at the exact same time. It's a real problem. You know, everybody thinks that we should be as dumb as our political parties seemingly want us to be, but we're not. We're much, much more complicated than that. And I love that. I actually run an organization called Narrative 4 where we do story exchanges between people. And you step into my shoes, I step into yours. Mm. And we did one on gun awareness where we took people from absolute opposite sides of the political spectrum and they told one another stories. And in doing so, telling a story rather than debating a political point, their lives changed. It was an extraordinary moment.
Wow. Do you trust the writers have to trust their readers?
I always trust my reader. My reader's smarter than I am, and I'm not just playing to the camp there. The people who come up to me and tell me afterwards what my book is about, they're the ones who actually know. I don't really know. Sometimes I'm operating on the fumes of mystery. I'm just on a wing and a prayer thinking, okay, I'm not sure why I'm doing this, but then someone reads it, they understand it, and they finish it for me. And so I trust my readers. I like my readers. And even when they get it differently to what I expect, like some writers get upset because somebody misinterpreted what it was that they had to say. I don't really give a damn about that. I think that's great. You create a new idea in someone's imagination. Let them go off and do with it.
Is that difference? Is there a difference between trusting your readers and liking them?
Well, you know, I'm a pretty you know, I actually also tend to like my readers because I like the world. I sort of get out and about and meet people and so I have to trust them and I really like them. I mean, I get critics every now and then who give me a good thump around and it's like, that's fair enough. But I will tell you, the first time I got a really bad prominent review, I saw this woman in a bar in Galway. And she sort of huddled away at the bar. She said, oh my God, there's a guy. And so I thought about it. I said, what am I going to do? So I walked over to her and says, you know that review that you wrote of my first novel? That was the worst written review I ever saw. And then I said to her, she laughed. And then I said to her, now, can I buy you a pint?
Yeah.
And I bought her a pint. And we sort of became friends. And I think sort of that's the way to deal with it rather than getting, you know, really upset. But you do remember the bad reviews more than you do the good reviews.
The ones that sort of gnaw at you and feed into that self-critic or the doubting critic on the shoulder.
If I meet him in a dark alleyway sometime, maybe I'll take my revenge.
You also write about the blurb. A blurb is pure pluffery. It's a form of literary porn. Most readers know they're being fluffed. And of course, you have some blurbs on the back of your book here. So what should, are you saying have blurbless
Yeah, well, I tried to go blurbless on this, although there's a funny thing at the bottom of the chapter about blurbs where Gary Steingart, who is a blurber extraordinaire and an incredible writer.
He's a wonderful guest,
He blurbs the chapter. You've had him on here.
Yes, I have, several times.
He's so funny, isn't he?
Yes, yeah.
So he blurbs my chapter on blurbing. Blurbing, unfortunately, is a necessary evil. It is, yes, a form of literary porn. It has to be there, unfortunately. Mm.
You have one from Oprah's magazine.
But that's a review. It's not so much a blurb. So a blurb is something that you invite another writer to say something nice about you.
Yes.
So I get, my postman hates me. He absolutely hates me because I get about 20 to 30 books a week from people who want to get blurbs. And so there's always letters inside. And I feel so bad because I can't respond to them all. Because if I spent my time just blurbing, that's what I would do. I'd become...
Do you blurb?
I'd blurb. For my students, I blurb. And occasionally I'll blurb for someone else. Can I tell you a little bit of a secret?
You can.
Oh, God, I shouldn't tell you.
Oh, no. You said the magic word. Go ahead.
Sometimes I get them to write their own dream blurb. And then I edit it down,
so
it's kind of a form of plagiarism in a way. But then they also, these young writers, they understand then what it takes to actually read a blurb or to write a blurb. You have to spend 2 days reading a book. Then you have to think about what the message of the book is and all of these things that come together. Yeah. And then you have to put it together in something, some sort of succinct and musical and you have to use words daring, inventive, lyrical, all that sort of thing.
All that sort of stuff. Do you think it's important for writers to be outsiders? I know, you're an immigrant to the U.S., so you weren't born here. But as I assume outsiders tend to be observers if they are observant people?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, some of the great literature is actually written by outsiders. If you think of, say, The Great Gatsby, Nick Carraway comes in, he's an outsider, and he's able to look more penetratingly at, the life there in East Egg and West Egg. As a person coming from abroad, yeah, it helps. Does a writer have to be an outsider? Not necessarily, mm-hmm. but I think it helps in a way.
How about this thing called writer's block? Do you believe in it?
Mm.
Has it happened to you?
I will tell you, okay, I used not believe in it. And I said it was a failure of the imagination, a failure of someone putting their arse in the chair and fighting against it. And I thought, well, there's just an excuse for a person not to do it. Then a couple of years ago, I was involved in an incident in Connecticut where I got I was helping a woman on the street who she was attacked. And I ended up later, I solved the whole thing without any violence whatsoever. But later on that evening, I got attacked outside a hotel by the person who I'd stopped from doing the thing. And to cut a long story short, I was in at a hospital for a couple of months. And I got down and I was unable to write. I was desperately unable to write and I had writer's block. And it wasn't until the court called me and they'd captured him and they were going to charge him and asked me to give a statement in the court that I actually sat down to write the first thing that I was writing for months and months and months. And at that time, I was blocked. And I sort of, I was a little bit ashamed of myself for telling people that there was no such thing as writer's block, because there is such a thing, but sometimes it's an excuse.
Was it because you had been beat up and you were, you were depressed? I mean, maybe traumatized and depressed?
I was traumatized, depressed. I kept thinking the person coming up behind me was going to take me out. Also, at first I tried to be sort of blasé about it, like oh, I lost my teeth, it was my Martin Amis moment or whatever, but the humor didn't work. Yeah. And then I started thinking about all those women who get and don't have a chance to speak out like the way or have a chance to go to court. All those people who get beaten up on the street or in their homes. And I thought how heroic it was. And then I also thought, well, I have to be able to tell that part of the story then too, which sort of bolstered me.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, telling the story is going to court and telling the story. I mean, that's
right.
Part of...
I mean, it's a great part of our judicial system, that the fact that we get to do a victim impact statement, I think it's really necessary. And in a way, all literature is a sort of extended victim impact statement, you know?
In fact, you say it's all about death, right?
Well, so much is about death or riding towards death, but also, you know, triumphing over death. Like, you know, because death will do a lot of things to us, and of course, it can take away homelands and it can take away houses and all these things, but it will never take away our stories. And you think about, say, your grandfather or, you know, your best friend or whoever it happens to be, they still somehow happen to live in the stories that remain about them. And this is one of the beauties of stories and literature and storytelling, is that we can keep people alive in a powerful way. That's why books are important for our kids and all sorts of people.
You also write, never forget that writing is the freedom to articulate yourself against power. It is a form of nonviolent engagement and civil disobedience.
Mm.
Even, or maybe especially fiction.
Yeah, I think so. You know, when you think about the way, if you were to write about, say, the Holocaust, right, and really communicate to people what it was to be around at that particular time, you almost slip a knife in under their skin, in a way. You almost wound them. But it's wounding them with a form of knowledge that is kind of extraordinary, because they come away, they're not scarred, but they're newly changed, and in this way, writing can articulate itself against power and be a form of nonviolent engagement and a confrontation of the ideas of violence and things like that.
You wrote a piece a couple of years ago in The New Yorker, The Word Shed. This was about your father, was a journalist, worked for a newspaper in Dublin. But you also write about listening. I mean, this is from the days of typewriters, but obviously listening to the sounds coming out of his word shed, the tapping of the keys and then the ringing of the bell and the sliding of the carriage.
It was great. I mean, my father wrote 27 books, God bless me.
He 27 books?
Yeah, 2 years ago he passed away, and he was always my first reader. And an interesting thing happened to me recently, without me even thinking about it. My dad had always read my stuff first, and then when he passed away, I turned to my son, who's 18 and he's a good reader, and just gave him some of the pages that I was working on, and I thought, oh wow, that's passing a mantle in a certain sort of way, keeping it in the family. There's always going to be a reader there for you.
Yeah,
you know.
Do you have a word shed place?
You know what? I write on a computer, and I wish I had the old click clack and like good write on.
This actually brought back really nice memories. That sound of the
typewriter. That sound is great. Yeah, and the bell
even.
Going across and stuff like. I used to work in a newspaper office where there was like about 100 typewriters going all at once, and the sound was fantastic. You know, and people shouting across the newsroom. Mm. And the Irish writer John Banville actually worked in that same newsroom.
Really,
and I used to see him sit over there by the copy. He was sort of very stern at the copy editing desk, and I thought, better be careful and make sure that I don't get something wrong for Mr. Banville.
Well, you also talk about the who, what, where, when, why, which is how journalists have to operate as
That's
well.
Right. That's
trying
right.
to get to all those parts of the story.
Yeah, you're supposed to get them in your first three paragraphs, right? The who, what, where, when, how, and why. I grew up as a journalist. I started as a journalist. I think it was a good way for me to engage, because I had a classic sort of I had a bad upbringing for a novelist, because I had a happy childhood, right?
So, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
I know, isn't that desperate? I wish I'd had some. I used to laugh with Frank McCourt, the late, great Frank McCourt, and I said, he got all the misery in Ireland, left none for me. And unfortunately, I had to make it all up. I feel lucky to be a writer. And I don't shy away from some of the tough things. That's important to me.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Colin McCann. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. The book is Letters to a Young Writer. And I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. And coming up next, we'll be talking about why it's so hard and why it's so important to say these two words, I'm sorry. Here's Peggy Lee to get us in the mood.
sorry, so sorry. Love could be so cruel. Oh, 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 yes. You tell me mistakes are part of being young, but I don't write the wrong that been done.
I'm sorry,
so sorry,
so sorry. Please accept my apology, but love is blind, and I was too blind to see.
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. United Airlines, Pepsi, and White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer have had a lot of explaining to do after a series of public gaffes. By now, you've seen the video of a man on a United flight being dragged screaming from his seat because of overbooking. It took CEO Oscar Munoz three tries to make a sincere apology after first regretting, quote, reaccommodating the passenger.
This can never, will never happen again on a United Airlines flight. That's my premise and that's my promise.
In the future, if no one voluntarily decides to leave a plane, based on the amount of money that United is offering,
we are not going to put a law enforcement official to take them off.
Spicer stepped in it when he said Syria's president was worse than Hitler and called Nazi death camps Holocaust centers. He apologized at a forum at the museum last week.
I made a mistake. There's no other way to say it. I got into a topic that I shouldn't have, and I screwed up. I mean, you know, and I hope people understand that we all make mistakes. I hope I show that I understand that I did that, and that I sought people's forgiveness because I screwed up. And and I hope each person can understand that part of existing is understanding that when you do something wrong, if you own up to it, you do it. You let people know, and I did.
Pepsi apologized for an ad featuring reality star Kendall Jenner joining a Black Lives Matter protest to give a police officer, yes, a bottle of Pepsi. We asked Edwin Battistella to join us, author of a book called Sorry About That, The Language of Public Apology. He's a professor of linguistics and writing at Southern Oregon University. And Edwin Battistella, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And to our listeners, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can also text and call our comment line, 267-405-2006. Tell us what you think a sincere apology should include. Edwin Battistella, let me put that same question to you, and we'll start on a positive note. What is a sincere apology? What does that sound like?
Yeah, I think a sincere apology is kind of like what your mother told you to do when you were a little kid and you did something wrong. You need to say what you did wrong, indicate that you're not going to do it again, and sincerely say you're sorry with no excuses or blame shifting.
Listening to Sean Spicer, and this was at the museum last week, did he get close to that? He said, look, I screwed up. It's my fault. I got in over my head. Was that close enough to a sincere apology?
Yeah, you know, I really don't think so. He's really kind of treating it too lightly, I think. It's sort of like the athlete that does something wrong and says, my bad. In a basketball game, you really don't have a lot of time to explore what you did wrong and why it was wrong and how you're going to do better in the future. But Sean Spicer could have gone into more discussion of sort of the moral implications of what he said and how he sort of dug himself in deeper. And I think a lot of the groups that were not impressed with his apology, particularly coming as it did during the Holy Week, it's the sort of thing where he ought to really explore what he did wrong and how he's going to not make these sorts of mistakes in the future, not just say, I screwed up.
Is there a difference between saying, I screwed up, or I'm sorry, or I apologize? Does that mean different things?
Yeah, it really does. I mean, if you say, I'm sorry, you can really just be reporting on a sort of mental state. If you say, I apologize, that sort of implies what we grammarians call a direct and indirect object. You apologize to someone for something. And that gives you an opportunity to really say what it was you did wrong. There are some great old examples of this where people just kind of, you know, they want to rush right to being forgiven and move on and not really talk about what the harm was that they did.
And it's important to say, not if you were offended, but clearly I offended you. I mean, to have some degree of ownership of what you've done.
Yeah, you have to name what you did wrong and own it. And if you just sort of shortcut to, I'm sorry if anyone was offended, or, you know, I regret that this happened, let's move on, then you're really not sort of treating the apology seriously, and you're not treating the people you've offended seriously.
Is there a go ahead.
And that's why many apologies take two or three times to really get it right.
Well, and that's a perfect example of that was the CEO of United, Oscar Munoz. The first thing was actually a statement that came from United. This is this doctor that was dragged from this airplane leaving from Chicago to Illinois. One of the things that United says, it was a brief statement: after our team looked for volunteers, one customer refused to leave the aircraft voluntarily and law enforcement was asked to come to the gate. We apologize for the overbook situation. You want to comment on that one? We'll start there. Go ahead.
First of all, I think reaccommodate is an early contender for the Dialect Society's Word of the Year, perhaps. We'll see what happens for the rest of the year.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so this was one, I call this the apology two-step or three-step, where people apologize very quickly and do it poorly, often with a particular audience in mind. And then as they either get a response from the people they've offended or the general public, they sort of rethink the apology. Sometimes there are consultants involved and eventually do a better job. So his third apology, where he really does take some ownership and identifies what's going to happen in the future, reviewing policies and not forcibly removing anyone, was a fairly good corporate apology. The first one was really not a very complete apology. And then there was a second one in the middle where he sort of addressed the internal staff and said that, you know, we can learn from this, but, you know, maybe the customer was at fault as well. So, it did. It took him several tries to sort of get it right.
How much do you think, and I'm thinking of United, and apparently the man that was dragged from the airplane is going to sue United, but how much do you think fear of lawsuits, especially with a public apology, fear of lawsuits makes it difficult to own what happened and to sincerely apologize?
Yeah, that's often the case in corporate apologies. So there's a sense that if you take moral responsibility, you're also taking legal responsibility. And I think there have been some studies that showed in medical situations, there are actually fewer malpractice lawsuits when a doctor or a hospital sincerely apologizes when something goes wrong. So I think the legal profession may not be, you know, they have a particular perspective,
right,
but they may not be taking all the factors into account here. So I think it's actually a good thing for people to apologize, even if there's some legal risk involved.
Let me read an email from Mark. He says, how does one apologize for ignorance or stupidity?
Yes.
Is there an apology for saying, basically, I'm a stupid person and that's why I said what I said?
Yeah, I mean, you can apologize for not knowing something. And, you know, the situation would really be to indicate how you're going to be less stupid in the future. So I think when I've apologized for, I've tried to apologize less since doing this research, but I'm trying to apologize better and for the things that I really do wrong. And when I do apologize, I try to do what Oscar Munoz did and talk about how things are going to be different in the future. And I think you can do that when you're ignorant of something. You're sort of committed to ignorance.
Right, which is a whole other thing. But are you saying the fact that you say that you now apologize less is that there is a danger of over-apologizing? And I know sometimes people just say, I'm sorry, out of a sort of a knee-jerk habit.
They do. I think you can say I'm sorry as a sort of empathy marker. And sometimes, like if, for example, I call you up and you're not in your office, your assistant might say, I'm sorry, Marty's not in right now. And it's not really an apology. Your assistant's probably just empathizing with the fact that, you know, I couldn't get in touch with you when I wanted to. So we do this all the time. And that's one of the differences between saying, I'm sorry and I apologize. Nobody's assistant would say, I apologize because Marty's
right,
not here.
Right.
Sorry and regrets are the kinds of things that can be, they can be ambiguous, and sometimes people sort of use that strategic ambiguity, and sometimes people will empathize, and it'll be taken as an apology, incorrectly.
That's Edwin Battistella. He's the author of a book that came out just a couple of years ago, Sorry About That, The Language of Public Apology. He's also a professor of linguistics and writing at Southern Oregon University. And we're talking about why it is so hard and also so important to apologize or to say, I'm sorry. There were several attempts at public apologies last week. And we want to hear from you again. You can send us an email. What do you think is a good apology? RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Again, text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. I don't want to give the impression that I apologize easily, because I think for all of us, and I don't have to do a lot of public apologies, occasionally I do, but even private apologies with people that you know and love and care about, it's really hard to admit that you've made a mistake. Why do you think that is? It makes us feel so kind of ashamed and vulnerable.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a little bit of sociology on this, and one of the things that comes up is this idea that when you make an apology, you're sort of splitting yourself into two people and condemning the earlier person, so that you sort of accept the shame of being a bad person in the past. And I think that's hard for all of us. We'd much rather say it's someone else's fault, you know, my staff messed up, or make some excuse, well, I did that because you made me do it, or, you know, because I didn't have any other choice. But it's hard to say, you know, I was a thoughtless jerk.
It sure is.
Or I'm ignorant.
A question from David. He says, in a business environment, is there a difference in the protocols for apology for the people at the very top of the organization versus the rest? If you're running a place, is it a different kind of apology that's required?
Yeah, I think there is. And this came up, I think, in the United apologies. You know, the sort of second apology tried to defend the staff a little bit. And, you know, I think you often get several apologies because there are several different audiences involved. So, you know, if I apologize to you for doing something, it's really just kind of you and me, and you can judge my sincerity by body language and tone of voice and things. But in a public apology, there's the United staff that may have felt they were hung out to dry. There are the shareholders and the sort of people who were involved with the brand more generally. There's the general public. There's the doctor who was removed from the plane and the other passengers who had to sort of endure all that. You've got several audiences, and it's often hard to satisfy all of them.
Well, we also live in this world, the Twitterverse, you know, the world of social media, which is critical and harsh and reactive and swift. These examples we've been talking about, I think, are examples of what that universe can do to really shut something down or to highlight something as well.
Yeah, that's true. I think there's a lot more attention to public apologies now that we're in this kind of 24/7 news cycle and things being posted on social media and YouTube and so on. And it's interesting because, in the years and years ago, you'd have someone come out and make a public apology. I'm thinking of people like Harry Truman, John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan. You know, they would make an apology, the press would ask a few questions, mm-hmm. and that would sort of be the end of it. Now things really do go on for quite a long time.
Do you have, we're about a minute or so before you have to say goodbye to you, do you have a favorite apology or perhaps non-apology?
I've got several. There are about 70 in the Sorry About That book. One of my favorites was George H.W. Bush, who was actually, you know, quite a polite guy and a good apologizer. And at one point he kept calling Ted Koppel Dan Rather because they were on a link up like this. And at the end, he just sort of apologized and he said, you know, Ted, I apologize for calling you Dan. I wasn't trying to be smart. and so you get those sort of things where people do own up, and they're often for smaller things, but they can be done well.
How about mistakes were made? How do you feel about
that
one?
That's a sort of interesting one. And particularly, I was sort of surprised that Richard Nixon never apologized, even though he was pardoned and he had sort of no legal reason not to apologize. But it just wasn't part of his nature. And we've all seen politicians like that.
Well, Edwin Battistella, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. Author of a book, Sorry About That, The Language of Public Apology. He's a professor of linguistics and writing at Southern Oregon University. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. Here's a montage of people demanding an apology from the 1980 film Popeye.
He owes me an apology. You owe me an apology.
You owe me an apology.
You owe me an apology.
You owe me an apology. Well,
you both owe me an apology.
You owe your sister an apology.
You owe me an apology.
Now, maybe you swabs can fool your intelligence and see that I'm asking you for an apology.